It sits in a fairly nondescript building in Canberra. And inside that building is a group tasked with protecting Australia on the digital frontier. Yes, this week on Download This Show, what do you learn when you go inside Australia's cybersecurity headquarters? Plus, Google has decided to stop advertising apps that help you stalk people, which seems, you know, like a thing they should already have stopped doing. And is one of the major video streaming services about to die? All of that and much more coming up. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell and welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed. It is a brand new episode of Download This Show, and joining us virtually from, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say, a living room is ABC technology reporter within the science unit, Ariel Bogle. Welcome back.
Hi, Mark.
Brought with you some spy gear, I assume.
Absolutely, always.
We'll talk about that in a second. And he is a software developer with Access Informatics. He's also with GovHack, which we are going to be talking about a little bit later on in the show.
Yay.
Peter Marks, welcome back.
Hi, Mark. I'm also in the living room, but a different one.
A different living room. Am I the only one here without a living room? Is that what this deal is now?
You've got a studio.
Put a couch in there, it becomes a living room. All right, let's start with spies, sort of. Ariel, you got invited into the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, which is...
It's a good question. So this involved a trip to Canberra, and I just have to say it was about the first time I'd left my living room in as many months. So journeyed down to Canberra because the Australian Cybersecurity Centre is part of the Australian Signals Directorate, and that is one of Australia's spy agencies, I suppose, one of the groups that look at intelligence, online intelligence especially. But the Cybersecurity Centre, which is located in the ASD, is a group that is meant to sort of push forward Australia's cybersecurity readiness. So they have all these teams there that monitor for online threats and try and raise Australia's sort of defensive posture, both for government and for business and individuals as well.
Yes, well, of course, not that long ago we had Scott Morrison, Prime Minister, get up and give a very, it's still a pretty odd press conference where he said we were under attack.
It was weird.
Yeah, it was weird. He said we were under attack but didn't quite say from whom or how, but everybody sort of just inferred it was China. And then this unit is somewhat involved in defending the nation from said cyber attacks.
Yeah, so there was a bunch of weird things about the Prime Minister's press conference a few weeks ago. Firstly, that it was not a new threat. The Cybersecurity Centre, at the same time as the press conference, released some advice online for anyone to look at that described the methods that the attackers were using to try and compromise systems. And they were pretty typical methods, nothing unusual, things that you could even probably teach yourself with enough time online. But the scale, I suppose, was what was the issue. But yes, teams at this place, especially the 24/7 monitoring room, are always online looking for clues about what might be happening. I mean, they told me they look at open source material, you know, blogs and forums and places where people share intelligence about cyber attacks and methods of attack and cyber criminal syndicates and all the rest. They receive intelligence from international partners, and also they have a tip line, so you can call them or send an email, and they obviously get multiple calls and emails and tips all times of the day from, you know, hospitals, individuals, all kinds of people if they suspect their systems are being attacked or have already been compromised.
What surprised you about the experience? What didn't you expect?
Well, I mean, this is not a super secret spy business, but I'm always surprised
by
the way.
Make it super secret spy. Make it super secret spy.
You know, these buildings down in Canberra, they always just look so dull from the outside. They look like, you know, it looks like an office park, like anywhere else. The first clue that there's something interesting going on inside was in the lobby, actually, where they had a kind of screen, a lattice with zeros and ones. And then you're like, well, okay, maybe this is where it's at.
Somebody saw The Matrix in 1999 and
exactly.
Became an interior decorator in Canberra.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess what was interesting to me to get a little behind the scenes is, I mean, this can be both a plus and a minus, I suppose, for Australia's cybersecurity readiness, was that was how many teams are involved. You know, there is the Cybersecurity Centre and its watch team. Then there's people from the Federal Police there as well. There are people from the Australian Criminal Intelligence Group that always are building these briefs about what criminal methods and attacks and origins. And then there's the international partners. And I guess at the big picture level, the responsibility for cybersecurity is divided over multiple government departments, you know, Home Affairs, the Attorney General's Department, and Defence as well, where the Signals Directorate sits. So, you know, you could look at that as having a lot of good opinions all in the mix, or you could look at that as having things kind of messy. And there's definitely a difference of opinion out there about that.
Peter, what's your level of confidence about Australia's cybersecurity?
Well, I think there's clearly a shortage of skills out there, people who are able to work out attribution. It's very difficult when we're being attacked. And remember, this is a broad range of attacks. There's denial of service attacks. Actually, it's interesting, just before the Prime Minister's press conference in June, Akamai, who runs a global caching service, had also reported that there was an uptick in worldwide denial of service attacks. Now, it's very difficult because machines are hacked around the world and then turned to attack typically the US or the UK, but also Australia. So it's very difficult to work out who's behind them. It's difficult here in Australia. I think you do need a global view. Some of the antivirus companies have these big maps, and they typically have impressive rooms that look rather like the NASA control room and that sort of thing, with screens everywhere, and you see animations of the lines of attack coming in from all over the place. So I think we're just a small fry in the whole thing because we don't tend to have a global reach as much as some others. But it does seem that there are attacks all the time, and COVID is being used, for example. Google has reported they used a submission to the Senate Select Committee on Foreign Interference Through Social Media. They say that they've found 18 million malware and phishing messages come through Gmail every day, and a lot of these are related to COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 is just the current thing that's on people's minds. So people who are doing these attacks are using social engineering to, I guess, make messages that you might expect to get, and then they somehow cause you to panic and log into Facebook or whatever it is that that then gives up your login details.
We should also say, if you're playing along at home and you're not familiar with the term, a denial of service attack is basically where you weaponize a bunch of different computers and whatnot to make requests of a certain service or a website, thus crashing it.
Yeah, just basically overloading it with traffic. So insecure computers, even Internet of Things, and you know, things like home web cameras can be weaponized and used to all attack the one server at a time and just bring it down, bring it to its knees.
Out of the conversations you had at the Cybersecurity Centre, what would you have liked to have known that you didn't get an answer to, that you feel comfortable sharing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Australia's readiness, I think the government in general could afford to be far more transparent about our level of readiness, because if you look at some of the audits of government departments here over the years, they often fail or are considered to be quite below par in their own cybersecurity readiness. You know, these are departments with immense amounts of very important information about Australians. That's one thing. The second thing, I guess, that is very hard to get anyone in government to pick up is the issue of nation state aggression against Australia. I mean, as you said, the Prime Minister's press conference nodded towards a state actor, and as you mentioned too, everybody jumped to China. The fact is, all the time, attribution, you know, the person who is, or the person or group or country behind an attack, is always difficult to work out for a variety of reasons. One is that all kinds of people use the same tools. You really have to be looking for particular clues and methods to determine it was one person or the other. And I guess at this point, I wonder if all this coyness about attribution, where that leads us. I mean, Australia has traditionally only been willing to point the finger at a Russia or a China or another country when it does it en masse with other countries like the United States and UK. So these are kind of the questions that went mostly unanswered, I have to say, when I went down there.
Well, I guess it's that awkward intersection between diplomacy and cybersecurity and crime fighting.
Absolutely.
And all that stuff that gets very thorny. Download This Show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. Mark Fennell is my name, and I don't know why I put so much emphasis on is, as though my name was likely to change.
It may change.
Sometimes, you know, deep bowl. I'm also joined by Peter Marks, software developer with Access Informatics. He's also with GovHack, and Ariel Bogle, technology reporter with the ABC's Science Unit. And Google have decided to take on stalkerware apps. But I might just start with you, Peter. What actually is stalkerware? If you've never heard the term before, What is it?
It's software which is used to stalk someone. So typically it's software that gets installed on, say, in a domestic violence situation, the victim's mobile phone without their knowledge. And then that software has a lot of access, so it can do things like access their location. It could maybe access the microphone. On Android, it's possible to access things like text messages. And so this software running on that person's phone without their knowledge can report back their movements, what calls they're making, what messages they're getting. I believe there's even been some that is able to intercept keystrokes and work out, you know, what the person's actually typing. So it's a very nasty piece of spyware installed on a mobile device.
Right. Forgive me, Ariel, but why was this stuff allowed in the first place?
Very good question. I suppose one reason is that a lot of this stuff is marketed as a way for parents to track children. I mean, that doesn't sound great on its face, but I know, you know, obviously a lot of parents and people in positions of responsibility for children have taken up tools that let them monitor where their kid is in a certain location. So that's one way that I think people have been able to market and get this kind of tech on these app stores. And I wanted to mention too, I mean, obviously spyware is a very particular category, but when I've looked at this issue myself, especially for, you know, the use of technology in family violence situations, it's always concerning how, you know, technology built for a completely different purpose can be weaponized. You know, these apps that kids use now at school, where parents can have a sort of page and teachers, you know, upload information about the school day or, you know, information about the kids' assignments or pictures of them in the classroom. Even these types of apps, if there is a family violence situation, can be weaponized by one of the partners who can use it to send messages to their partner or track where their child is. And often, because these are private companies for the most part, it can be hard to remove the partner from access to this kind of tech. So, you know, it depends what you mean by spyware, I suppose, but it, as a sort of big category, almost any bit of technology used in the right, wrong way can become spyware.
It's worth pointing out, Peter, that both Apple and Google have removed a lot of these apps from their services already, haven't they?
Yeah, they've removed them from their app stores. But on Android, of course, it's possible to sideload apps to load an app onto a phone just by connecting it to a computer. And a lot of people do turn that on because they want to turn that ability on because they want to be able to put games or something that aren't in the store. So there is a way around there. Apple, I think, is more secure in that sense. And Apple's also increasing the security in iOS 14, which we'll get in probably September this year, where it shows up indicators to show that, say, the microphone is active. There's also indicators showing if you're being tracked. So it is a bit more easy to see that something strange is going on the device.
It is. One of the other interesting parts of the story, Ariel, is I think this is a demonstration of how Google uses its ad policy as a sort of way of shaping the internet somewhere.
Yeah, so in this case, Google has decided that spyware will no longer be allowed to be advertised on its platform. It's different, you know, I guess, than a full-blown ban, and they did carve out an exception for technology and apps that would allow monitoring of children. So that is a carve-out that, you know, seems pretty ripe for exploitation, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
But yes, certainly they can use those rules around the App Store and their platform to shape what kind of products are easily available and monetizable.
How do you delineate between something that's designed for child safety and something the raw functionality can still be used to stalk people? How do they delineate between those two ideas, Peter?
Well, that's right. It really comes down to intent. And I think the answer is got to be that the devices actually tell the user a lot more about what's going on. I mean, when you look at the amount of monitoring that apps do, and some of this is coming up in the betas of iOS 14, which is now reporting on things like apps accessing the clipboard, whatever you've last copied. Mm. And we've seen a bunch of apps that got into trouble because why are they accessing the clipboard? LinkedIn was one that was found to be accessing whatever you'd copied many times, you know, like every second and things like that, which they say was a bug, but other software may be doing that. And, you know, maybe you copy a password or you copy a Bitcoin wallet ID or something, and that could be, you know, exfiltrated out
you know, to someone without your knowledge. So what's happening, I think, is the operating systems are getting more secure and are telling you. Apple's doing, I think, a good job in this. The new version of Safari is going to report back on all sorts of data, which is being how you're being tracked when you visit a web page. And they're doing the same thing with apps, not just the camera, the phone, location, you know, all of these sorts of things. So I think people, unfortunately, it's a bit of a pain because you're constantly asked, can this app have permission to do this or do that? The key thing there is, though, if your phone, if you're a victim of this and your phone is accessible by someone else who wants to stalk you, then they can install an app and give all of those permissions. And that, I guess, comes back to the question as well, how do you know you're being stalked? If the person who's stalking you seems to know a lot about what you're doing, where you're going, who you're talking to, then perhaps it's time to have a look at your phone.
Just on that point about different apps collecting or keeping track of what's in your clipboard, I mean, there are quite a lot of apps and websites that use what's in your clipboard to sort of help you log in and things like that. Is it possible? I know certain, we talked about it last week, but I know certain services regard it as a bug, but is it also possible that it's a something that's been designed for a convenience factor?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it can be used for evil and good. The Reddit app was one which was the finger was pointed at it because it was accessing the clipboard when you opened the app. And they came back and said, no, the reason we do that is if you're about to share a URL, then what we'll do is have a look at the URL you've copied in the clipboard and parse it to try and work out a suggested title for the post. And everyone's kind of was up in arms at first, but then when this was explained, they went, yeah, that's pretty good. But I, for one, wouldn't mind if I went over to an app that wanted to access a clipboard, if it actually popped up and said, can I have permission to get to read the clipboard?
But then does it become a bit like that cookies thing where, like, people just clip through it without ever thinking about it? It's a thing, but it's a bit pointless at the same time.
It's about like end-user license agreements when you have to scroll through 50 pages and you just go, yes, I just want to use this thing, say yes to everything. I know, and that's always going to be a balancing act. But I think that there comes a time when you've got to say, I just need to perhaps do a bit of spring cleaning and have a look at the apps that I've given permission to, go through the list and say, why is, and this is a real example, something that purports to be a battery monitor, why is it accessing my microphone? You know, really, do they really need all of these sorts of accesses? And maybe do a bit of spring cleaning and turn them all off.
Mm. Download This Show is what you're listening to, and the one streaming service that I, and apparently I alone, love to talk about, Quibi, which stands for Quick Bites, has been an, what's the technical term? Unmitigated disaster, Ariel? would that sum it up so far?
Maybe so. I do think you are the one true Quibi obsessive, I have to say.
No one else in this country talks about it. It's available. It's totally, okay, I'm going to bring people up to speed. So, this was a service that initially when it was launched, you could only get on a mobile phone. There were 6 to sort of 10 minute episodes. It had a cool function where you could watch things vertical and you could watch it horizontal, so you could turn your phone. Lots of big names, lots of money. So you had shows from like Anna Kendrick and there was, you know, Guillermo del Toro. Like I still maintain, and I am out on a limb here, I think Ray Johnson might join me on this limb, that some of the content was fine. But there was a really, like, quite horrifying story that came out in the last couple of days about just how badly it has tanked, partially in the age of COVID, maybe just because they didn't read the room, Ariel.
Yeah, that's right. So Quibi, when it first launched, there was quite a generous free trial period, and that turned off around July 4, I think, in the United States. And apparently, according to data that TechCrunch, the tech website, collected, a lot of people did not continue. They said 92%, which is just a staggering number. And I think that Quibi does dispute it. But either way, it's just not a very good news story for this fledgling multi-million dollar backed tech platform.
Yeah, it's hard to frame them as the underdog when they've got like Steven Spielberg on board, isn't it?
And also, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg is one of the founders and he's a former head of Disney, and alongside Meg Whitman, you know, the former head of Hewlett Packard, like these people are not minor, but they seem to have lacked some understanding potentially of how people consume content today or what kind of content they want. And I really have to shout out a huge piece on this in Vulture, the New York Magazine culture website, which is just staggering and is full of the most bizarre anecdotes. And it really makes you wonder what people thought was going to be achieved here.
It is a remarkable piece. Jeffrey Katzenberg still gets his emails printed out and things like that. And there's an inference that perhaps maybe these two were not the best place to generate a streaming service for the mobile age. Yes, the youth, as they say.
You know, I can see that things like TikTok are great for these short-form video and the idea that maybe you could then use that for watching, you know, major productions from Disney, Fox, Sony and many others. I mean, they really plan to spend up big. It wasn't for fear of, you know, it wasn't for lack of budget. $1.1 billion to make 8,500 episodes. I mean, it was a really ballsy kind of operation. Now, you know, they did well. At first, they had 1.7 million app downloads in the first week, which is a good sign. But as you said earlier, it was a free trial. And the challenge of converting people from a free trial to being paying customers is big. And even Disney had, you know, they reckon they have about 11% conversion between people who try the free, you know, trial first off and then go and sign up, which is really what you want them to do. But they fell out of the top 50 in the first week. And by June, they fell out of the top 1,000 apps, according to Sensor Tower. As you've said, they do question some of these external statistics, but it's clear they're in trouble. Maybe it was timing with COVID-19 that changed people. You know, they're no longer on public transport watching video. Instead, they're at home where they can watch longer form.
I mean, how much danger are they in here? Like, do you think they might fold, or do you think their form of content might actually find an audience?
Well, certainly with the amount of money that's behind it, I don't think it's something that will fold right away, especially with all those names attached. But I wanted to bring up, I'm not sure exactly how Quibi fits into how content evolves today. You know, it's interesting to look at platforms like TikTok and YouTube, which really lets organic content creators rise to the top. You know, people with charisma and a story to tell and a unique perspective start gaining an audience on TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, for example, and they build that into potentially at one point a show on a platform like Netflix or a cable network, etc. That's the story for Issa Rae, who's a creator in the United States who had a show on YouTube and now has a show on, I believe, HBO in the United States.
Yeah, Insecure.
So Insecure, exactly. So I wonder if the Quibi offering steps too closely into the place where people want more low budget but more authentic organic content. And so it's just not really gelling with how people consume content on their phones in this quick scrollable way.
And just lastly, it is the app that I've probably talked about more than anything on the show over the last couple of weeks. But TikTok has faced a pretty tumultuous year. It's been banned in certain markets and certainly talked about being banned and even more. And then, of course, there's the issue of its own community as well, Peter. I know there's been a few bugs that has really angered its user base.
Yeah, recently something went wrong with view counts and they didn't show. I don't think that was deliberate, but that did annoy the users. But yeah, look, the app collects a lot of information, IP addresses, carrier info, device identifiers, even keystroke patterns, which is an interesting one. It's being banned by companies, including Wells Fargo. They are acting to try and allay those fears. I believe they're going to move out of Hong Kong. They've got an office in Hong Kong, and of course, the laws have changed in Hong Kong recently. So they are fighting back, but it's going to be really tough for them to get respect again.
I think with TikTok, we sort of need to hold multiple things in our minds at once. There's multiple truths about TikTok. I mean, the first one is that it is an immensely popular app, which is forming a significant part of culture. So I think that does need to be, you know, discussed and somewhat respected, because it is like YouTube before it, like Vine before that. It is forming like a new sort of cultural mode of display and celebrity, and so that is really interesting. The second thing is it is a mass data collection apparatus, but is it more than other apps? You know, I think the Washington Post had a close look at that, and they found that it was, you know, about on par with Facebook. So it's not like the level of data collection it carries out is completely unprecedented. But the third thing is, of course, and you can't deny that it is an app with a Chinese parent company, ByteDance. And all Chinese companies are responsible in some way to the Chinese government, particularly through a piece of legislation in 2017 called the National Intelligence Law, the number one law that people bring up when they talk about their concerns over TikTok, because it places an obligation on Chinese companies to assist with intelligence gathering if leaned upon by the government. So really, there's nothing in its current form that TikTok can do to assure governments in the United States, in Australia and India, which has banned the app, to assure them that that law will never apply to them and that data from users outside China will never be shared within China, especially with the government. So there's multiple, these are all true, but all sort of an impossible morass for TikTok to wade through. And I think one that is starting to creep onto the radar of its users, its millions, if not billions of users.
As you mentioned, the US is considering or has talked about banning TikTok. My question is that even viable? Like, is that actually a doable thing in the United States, Peter?
Well, you can remove it from the store, which means that new users can't install it, or if you get a new device, you can't re-download it. But short of blocking its servers or something like that, which I guess is possible. Yeah, Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, has said that they're looking at it. I think Trump mentioned it the other day, which is the best publicity you could possibly ask for an app. But there are alternative apps. There's Byte, Dubsmash and Likee, and I believe that users are leaking across to some of those. I mean, it's very easy for apps to copy each other. And it's all about the community. If people move across to something else, then one app can disappear, another one can take its place as the short form video, jokey sort of lip syncing home. But yeah, at the end of the day, they seem to be being attacked from multiple fronts. I can't see a way out of it other than changing their ownership.
Yeah, it's an app like firmly in the middle of a geopolitical showdown. You know, this is the United States versus China. This is India versus China. And an app like TikTok, on which people make 15-second dance videos, gets caught up in that. It's just fascinating, as well as being a security issue.
So what happens next, Ariel? How do you think this is going to play out?
Obviously, the United States is making a lot of noise about this. And I think it's pretty clear that the US, along with Australia, has been behind the push globally to push Chinese technology companies out of other countries. Huawei is probably the most significant example of that, the pressure that Australia and the United States put on other countries not to allow Huawei to develop 5G networks in the UK, in Europe, etc. Can they do the same with TikTok? It's not clear at this point, and I think we're still pretty far from a ban here in Australia too. For now, the only thing that has happened really is that a Senate committee that's looking at foreign interference through social media is planning potentially to call TikTok executives, TikTok management to testify, and that's where we're at.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. We are out of time. Peter Marks, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
Peter Marks is with Access Informatics and also with GovHack. Now, actually, if people have never heard of GovHack before, I might let you explain it.
Thanks. Yeah, look, it's Australia's biggest open data hackathon. And, of course, normally at this time of year, it takes place at locations all over Australia and New Zealand. But this year, it's going to be totally online. The competition is on the weekend of the 14th to 16th of August. There's also a two-week virtual conference in the lead-up from the 20th to the 31st of July. For more information, please visit govhack.org.
My goodness, it's almost like you had a script in front of you.
Totally just made that up.
Do check it out if you're interested in getting on board. And Ariel Bogle, thank you so much for joining us back on the show.
Thanks, Mark.
And if you want to check out Ariel's inside look at Australia's cybersecurity watch room, all you need to do is check out the ABC News website. And with that, I will leave you. My name has been Mark Fennell, and I'll catch you next time on Download This Show.